Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
Gary LeMaster.
And we have a guest, Gary, in the studio today, a man who's running for public office in Arizona. Why don't you introduce him to our audience?
Our guest is running for a state legislature in LD6, Alex Martinez. He's a Navy vet and a longtime educator, and I'll kind of let you fill in from there, Alex.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background, Alex. What your career has been about, and why you've chosen to run for office. So it's very hard to get people to run for office these days. It tends to be
especially Democrats in Arizona.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so we, I guess as Democrats, we thank you for standing up, you know, because like very few people want to run for office in the current environment.
Well, Steve and Gary, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to your program so I can get my message out to Verde Valley. Again, my name is Alex Martinez. I'm running for the State House in Legislative District 6, which is a very large area. If you take a look at the map, we're in Coconino, Yavapai, Gila, part of Navajo. So I have put on 12,000 miles in the family car, and I'm going to have to buy my wife a new car because I've just about worn it out driving back and forth and meeting members of our LD community, LD6 community.
Well, I think what's scandalous is you're using her car rather than your car. It is this huge district. Is it larger than Connecticut and Massachusetts combined, and almost the size of Pennsylvania? It's huge.
It's large, and you don't want to drive too often out in the dark, because I was coming back from Payson the other day, and huge, large herds of deer and elk, and so you've got to be very careful. But we're getting our message out there wherever folks will listen to us. Let me just tell you, first of all, my family's been in Arizona before it was a territory. We go back quite some time ago. My mother's family came over from the old country. They came out here to help build churches and were part of the trail of setting up Catholic churches along the trail here. And they were plasterers and rock masons, and they came here to establish the church. My father's family came over. They were sheep herders. They came back most recently, probably the late 1800s, to ranch. So we've had a long history here. My grandfather was in World War I. My dad and his four brothers were in World War II. My brother and I served during the Vietnam War. And we both retired from the Navy Reserve as Navy captains. But we had 6 years enlisted service where college, going to junior, not to junior college, we were undergraduates. We had 4 years of attending meetings, and then when you graduate from college, you went on active duty for 2 years. So that's the beginning of our military background. I reported to the boot camp at Naval Training Center San Diego at the end of my junior year in high school, and I had that summer to go to boot camp, and I was 17 years old, and I remember getting there with a bunch of other university kids, and not having been away from home by myself. We're all kind of a little leery and a little bit afraid, especially when the old DI came out and started screaming at everybody. But we knew that we had a duty to do, and we didn't especially want to be there. We'd rather have been at the university, but we did our commitment and then some. So I was enlisted for 6 years. I came out as a petty officer, second class. Had a 10-year break in service. Went back to school, graduate school. Earned a master's in education and then my doctorate, and I became a school teacher. And the reason I became a school teacher, because I had just super instructors in high school. Most of these fellows and ladies had been in World War II. These were veterans who became educators, and I was really inspired by them. I mean, listening to their stories, and a lot of them were telling me the thing that saved them was the military. because they had the GI Bill of Rights to go back to school. And what was good about my era, we also had the GI Bill of Rights, so I always wanted to go to graduate school. So that was another reason that I joined. And coming out of that, I became a school teacher, and I taught middle school, high school, became a principal and a superintendent. And I had four superintendencies, and I retired in 2000 quite young, and I moved to Coronado to work in the Chula Vista School District as a building principal. I had a ticket to punch in the reserves, a billet I had to have on my list, because I had been screened for admiral, for rear admiral. And so we moved to California. And after one year there, I was offered an opportunity to apply for a superintendency in Main Consolidated District, which is a very small district. It's a feeder school district of Flagstaff. But they were having issues with the state and were in jeopardy of being in serious trouble. So with the Arizona Education, but the Arizona School Administrators Association would hire retired administrators to go into situations like this because they were experienced and they knew how to set things up properly and make sure that they...
So you're basically kind of a troubleshooter for a troubled educational district.
Oh, absolutely. And there were several of us who were out there doing this because they knew, first of all, we were from Arizona. We knew what the rules and regs were. We knew various programs, and it would be easier for us to put school districts back into compliance who are out of compliance. It was a challenging job, but you know what? It was probably one of the most satisfying jobs I ever had. And from there, I went on to Sanders School District, went over to Loop to help them out, and then Kayenta, which is up in Kayenta itself. It's part of the big mining community, coal mining community. And then I took a two-year hiatus to work at Veterans Issues because that's always been close to me. And an opportunity arose to take the largest geographic school district in the United States. It's the Lower Yukon. It starts at the mouth of the Yukon and the Bering Sea and goes up 400 miles, and there are 11 districts here. A lot of flying. And I think that's one of the very few people who got tired of salmon, because every place I went, I got free salmon. But just wonderful communities, people there share.
So they took one look at you and said, here's a free salmon.
Absolutely. Hey, that's one way of paying you for your hard work. But their communities reminded me about what education was all about. It's about communities. It's about local control and parents having a say about what goes into that classroom in terms of who do we hire. They have input into curriculum. And if something doesn't work, they have the ability to change policies to make things work.
Well, how is that different from the current movement to have vouchers and to have seeming there are now a lot of people that, I mean, to a lot of folks, public education has been the triumph of American actually, of our whole culture and our government. We started public education in a lot of ways, and now there are a lot of people who are against it and want to have vouchers and stuff, and they claim that they'll have more say that way.
Absolutely. That's the felonious. That's incorrect. First of all, the United States of America has the best educational system in the world. And we hear we're not as good as the Japanese, the Swedes, et cetera. But what they're talking about is a very limited population of the sample of people of students that they are evaluating. These are kids who are top 5-10% of their students. And when you see that type of information in the newspaper about their students being that much more ahead of us in math and science, it's only for the top 5-10%. The nice thing about our public schools is we take everybody who walks through those doors in spite of their ability. And we have children who walk through there who are just super geniuses, and we have kids who go through there who have issues in learning. So every one of those kids is going to be taken care of. Now, again, the greatest institution in this country is the public schools. It isn't the military. It isn't Wall Street. It's the public school system because it impacts everything we do. If we have a well-educated, highly skilled workforce, our economy is only going to boom because we're the innovators. This country, if you look at it, we're the Boeings, we're the IBMs, we're the 3Ms, we're the folks who develop things and make things. We don't copy them. And it all comes from public schools. Most of those kids, most of those innovators, inventions come from people who went to public schools. Now we talk about public schools versus our private schools. Well, vouchers is a welfare, is creating a welfare state. It's really a welfare ticket. It's a welfare ticket for the rich. And lo and behold, you tell them that and they get a little bit upset, but you're paying for their kids' private school.
It's taking money away from public schools to give to private. And there have been studies on this. Stanford University did a study on comparing charter schools, for example, with public schools. And despite the ability of charter schools to select their students, and despite the fact that the parents are generally a little more well off, the performance between the two, public and charter was relatively the same. There's no real advantage.
And you're correct. That is correct. And again, if you look at charter schools, they're for profit. Public schools are not for profit. They're a business. They're not going to give you the customer satisfaction, as I like to call it, in public schools. Because if you have an issue in public schools, let's say you have a child who has a disability. If you go to a charter school, they may or may not have that specialist for learning disabilities, for speech therapy, for physical therapy, job therapy. And the list goes on. These are the services that public schools provide. Charter schools can turn away students. We don't turn away anybody because they are public schools.
I think there was one really interesting difference pointed out at the beginning of the school year is that a large charter school in the Phoenix area, the kids showed up for school, the parents had already paid, and the kids showed up for school and found the doors locked. And the teachers were all laid off and they had closed the school.
That's absolutely correct. If you talk about employees, they don't have the same protection as they would if they were employees of a public school. Charter schools became a big business. If you drive through a large urban area, you'll see big neon signs advertising their schools. Some actually just do it online. I don't know how they can get away with it, but they do. And they count the student. They're getting the aid per student.
Alex, in your opinion, is it actually, are these schools and the way the money is be distributed in Arizona, there's a bunch of scandal with the scholarships and all of this stuff. Is it actually undermining the strength of public education?
Every time that we give a dollar to private schools, we are taking a dollar out of your neighborhood school, the school that your children, your grandchildren go to every day. They can walk to, ride their bike to it. They are being undermined. That dilutes the various programs that we have. For instance, if we have programs for gifted kids, that's taking money away from that program. If we have children with learning disabilities, that dilutes their program as well because we don't have the same amount of money to be able to fund those staff levels.
Are the current state representatives from our district, are they pro-education, Brenda Barton and Bob Thorpe? Are they pro-education folks? Are they supportive of public education and from I guess, what, kindergarten all the way through university or not?
Well, if you look at their literature, they say they're pumping millions of dollars into education, but what they're not telling you, they're pumping it into private education, not public education. They're taking public money and putting it into private education with vouchers and charter schools. So, no. A few years back, the Republicans tried to cut funding for kindergarten. We one of the few states that only has a half-day kindergarten program. And some school districts, the community has made up the difference to make with their local funding to make it a full day. But they were, the Republican Party's Bob Thorpe and his cronies there want to cut it out because they call it babysitting. Well, what they don't understand, and obviously because they just went to school, they think they're experts in it, is that the most critical year of a child's education is going to be in preschool. we make them or lose them. If we can identify issues that students have so we can remediate or expand on if they're gifted kids. So, and that's going to happen again. They're going to try and cut out kindergarten classrooms.
Are they just stingy? Do they just not want to spend the money, or they really, really in some level, don't understand, the importance of education, and, education in the classroom?
Well, first of all, I don't think they value education. And if you look at the back, educational backgrounds of some of these legislators and our governor who just left, who got her GED just before she finished up her term as governor, they don't really value education.
And you know, Thorpe and Barden in particular are far too busy railing against the federal government and trying to take, you know, federal lands for the state that they don't have time to, or they don't want to be bothered with things like education.
Absolutely. They get involved in all these peripheral issues just to get away from what the real issues are and we should be focusing on.
How will you be different than Bob Thorpe and Barton, who are focused on all these far right wing ideological issues,
conspiracy theories,
all this kind of crazy stuff? I know when they present themselves to the voters, like you said, they present themselves as public education supporters, and I mean, I even get these telephone calls from them. But how would you be different? What would your time, if you're elected, how would you do things differently in the state legislature?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to keep my eye open, because there is a movement within the Republican Party to be co-signers of private enterprises, charter schools, corporations that have private schools. They want to borrow money, and they want the state of Arizona, you the taxpayer, to co-sign and guarantee their loans. That's going to be one of the first, that's another giveaway that'll take money out of our public school funding. Because if they go belly up, they go broke, who's going to pick up who's going to make that loan good? You and I, the taxpayers. But again, it's that money is going to come out of the fund that provides public school education. And that's not a conspiracy. That is the truth. That is the movement that they have right now. And they kept it under the wire until after the election.
So this would go beyond what's being done now, right, Alex, in terms
Absolutely.
Of vouchers. This is, explain the program a little more to folks, because I think a lot of people have not heard it.
Well, you know, a voucher is, what they're saying is that money is following the student to another school. Well, some of these are sectarian schools, which are wonderful schools. I went to sectarian school for a couple of years when I was a young kid. But that money is going to be taking the funds away from our local public schools. Vouchers are not a good idea. I'm all for choice. And if you want to pay for a public school for your child, you've got the opportunity to do it. But I don't think I'd be subsidizing your choice when you have a perfectly good public school in your neighborhood to attend.
And if you think that, you know, I think a lot of people in Arizona think that the passage of Prop 123, which, you know, gave some more funding to the public schools, was the solution. But if you look at the numbers, the state of Arizona spends about $7,800 per student for public schools. The national average is like $11,300 per student. So we're far, far below the public average, or the national average. And we rank according to, depending on which thing you look at, we rank either at fourth worst or fourth lowest for school funding to the lowest. So if you think this issue has been resolved, it hasn't, and there's a long, long way to go.
We're funding our schools like a third world country. We're 48th in the nation. Don't be surprised if you look at everything else in the last four school bottom of the totem pole schools funding states, that we'll be 50th. After we lose our money to vouchers, loans. 48th in the nation is what Brenda Barden and Sylvia Allen were saying, well, we have to balance the budget. Well, they're balancing the budget on the backs of the future of our country. The best investment that we can make as a nation is to invest in human capital. That means we're investing in ourselves. We're investing in our children. And if you look at it, if we want to really bring good jobs that have a living wage and offer good benefits, the only way you're going to do that is by having a skilled workforce. The IBMs, all the big companies are not going to locate here, because if we don't have that skilled force, they're going someplace else. But look at it this way, long term. You have a workforce that's well educated, and we have good companies with good jobs coming in. Those folks are going to be productive. They're going to be paying our taxes. They're putting more money back into our education. I'm sorry, into our economy, because they're highly educated. And unfortunately, Thorpe, Barton, and Ms. Allen don't understand that. Again, their view of education is what can I get out of it for myself? And again, they have interest in private schools and charter schools. That's a conflict of interest.
Who has an interest in?
Well, I think it's Sylvia Allen, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. So, if in the voucher-based schools, the charter schools and stuff, are there school boards that where people run for office and you can vote for somebody you think is good or not, or are they sort of beyond public control in a way?
That's a big difference between the public school and the private schools. Those boards can be appointed by the owners of the public schools. So when parents have concerns, who do they go to? The corporation? Are these open meetings? No, they're not. At the beginning of every school board meeting, you usually have a thing called a call to the audience, where people can be given a certain amount of time. They go up there and they either voice a concern or they praise their schools. But you're not going to have that with the private school.
And they get to vote for who controls it. You don't really know. I mean, is it, or maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think the problem with some of those private schools, you don't know really who owns them and runs them. I mean, people don't ask enough questions because they just don't, I guess.
Well, they don't. Your school boards are elected by your local community. They represent you. They should be mirroring your community and the values of your community, the type of programs that you want your kids to be involved in. They can also be the check and balance for your school administration and for your school board. Those are all part of our system, the great American system, because they represent our communities.
And it's now a tradition of public schools for 120, 30?
It's a long, it's getting close to 150 years.
150 years.
And again, how many countries have that ability to be able to have the public be involved with the institution?
Why do we turn our back on things that we invented a lot, like public schools? I mean, I went to both Catholic schools and
right.
public schools, and they're both good in their own way. And I will say the public school had much more diverse students. There were different ethnic groups, and there were different racial groups there than when I went to Catholic school. Why are we turning back? Why are we turning our backs on our public lands? For example, we invented the idea of national parks. There are national parks now all over the world, modeled on our national parks and monuments. Yet we seem to be turning back, or are back, or there are people advocating that we do it. Right, Gary? On some of our greatest achievements.
One of the strange things I find about this whole anti-public school attitude is that, as the country was settled by European settlers, when a group of people, when enough people got into a settlement, one of the very first things they did was open a school and bring in teachers to teach their children. It was a premise that pervaded the entire country. It's what helped build the country, and now we're trying to tear it down. I don't understand it.
And that was the backbone of our country, period. That's what built this country. That's what made us great. People invested in public schools because the founders knew that they wanted a better life for their kids. And if you look at our schools right now, as we look at the privatization, you have to ask yourself why. And the reason is people really don't know. We haven't been able to do a very good job of educating, and that's why I decided to run, to make communities aware about what was happening to them and why it was happening. It's all by design. It's to privatize public school education. You will no longer have an opportunity to voice your opinion or have input into your child's education or how it's run and how it's going to be paid for. If you look at our economy right now, it's eroding. Our middle class, working class, it's an erosion. We need help. We have an erosion of the middle class and working class. We need more money in our classrooms to come up with voc-tech programs. I'm afraid that we've lost those factory jobs. We're not going to be, because even if we had them, they probably would be performed by robots.
That's one of, I think, the biggest fallacies about this whole Make America Great thing again, is we'll bring jobs back into the country, manufacturing jobs. We've lost far more manufacturing jobs to robots than we have to other countries.
What public policies, Alex, could be changed to strengthen the middle class? I mean, Gary's right. We're facing really serious challenges in the future, like automation, artificial intelligence. But what public policies can you do that will help the middle class? I mean, what's a bad policy for the middle and working class folks, and what's a good policy?
Well, a good policy is to make sure we have proper funding, not just for public school, but post-secondary schools, which are junior colleges and high schools. Right now, if you look, we hired teachers that had $100,000 in debt. There's no way they're going to be able to pay this off. So we need to have policies and develop where we can help students get through college, get a degree that has meaningful job skills that will get them a job when they graduate. And we can do this in education. We can do it in industry. We can do it in medicine. We need to refocus on our infrastructure. And the infrastructure, not just in bridges, but the infrastructure intellectual in our workforce infrastructure, by putting more money into our educational programs. And if you want to have public schools be successful, you don't do it by giving away part of the money that's in the pot, which is barely enough to make your maintenance and operation budget work.
And one of the things is that one of my pet peeves with education is that there's too much focus on training and not enough focus on critical thinking. I've talked to a number of college educators and former region board of regents and university presidents, that the most important thing that you can take away from post-secondary education or any form of education is critical thinking, learning how to solve problems, learning how to study issues and come up with your own solutions. That's what makes entrepreneurs. That's what solves our nation's issues. And we don't put enough emphasis on that at any level of education.
We need to look at our curriculum, and it has to be reshaped. If you stop and look at how nuclear fission and how we developed the bomb and how IBM and other companies developed their products, it wasn't in isolation and one sole person in that business or in that community doing it, but it was by committee. And IBM made a study decades ago on the success of their programs. It's because it worked collectively. It was called teamwork. And the Japanese also understood that was very important. We don't generally teach teamwork because we're so engrossed in just an individual. We need to learn to work collectively as groups, like think tanks.
The thing is, even if you're a machinist, there's creative machinists working with most scientists to design the tools and stuff they're using to test. I mean, it's as deep a creativity as any of them to be a machinist and come up with new ideas and new solutions to the problem. I've met some of these folks. I'm deeply impressed with them. And so that requires critical and also creative thinking to be able to work with a group of people to solve problems. And you think there's a de-emphasis on the collective attack on the problem? I don't think in business, you still I mean, if you're a producer, you don't suddenly fire the art director and decide you can do it yourself, because you can't. You know what I mean? And you don't get rid of, right, Gary? You don't get rid of the personnel, because to get a, say, an ad out is can be a lot of work.
Each profession is a skilled profession. And one of the problems I have with the whole training mentality, I mean, I think it, you know, CTE type education is really useful. Technical education. But I think, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen trends change so rapidly that you get trained for one thing, and 10 years later, that job no longer exists. So you need, if you don't have the ability to adapt and have critical thinking, you're going to find yourself on the outside looking in.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of my experiences is with the University of Arizona Medical School was following some of the programs they have for cancer and for a heart surgery. They have engineers. They have artists, like you were just talking about. It's a whole team that works on the problems to solve it. And another thing is, it was really interesting, one of our sonars systems when I first went in the Navy, we had all the folks who developed it, all the big engineers, but there was one simple little critical step they missed. It was a 19-year-old kid who was a sonarman and pointed out, maybe we need to move this electromagnet a certain way, but they never looked at it because they were looking at just their one portion of it, and this kid was working with the whole system.
He's actually working and running the system.
Right. He's
the guy who knows.
He's the owner of it at that time.
And he's like 19 years old, and he comes up. Once you start cutting out that kind of creativity at all different levels, I mean, I think we all agree that would begin to generate a problem. In the military, it would be. Could be a deadly problem.
Oh, absolutely. You don't say oops in the military. Say too late. Those are the words you don't want to ever hear too late. But let me tell you about the Japanese force. Everybody was saying they were so much better than we are. They were really smart. And this is where IBM copied them as well. They made decisions at the closest point of implementation. Let me tell you, if you're working on that line and you're putting that card together, nobody knows more about that function that you're doing than you. We had engineers who were sitting up in their offices, you know, looking at all the models, but nobody knew more about it than the person who was working on it. This is what we have to look at. We need to listen to and work with people at all levels of the workforce within a community.
I know you want to be positive about your opponents, but I think you have a very, very different orientation than they do, and it's almost like, to me, they're absorbed in their ideological ideas about education, about public lands, about defense, conspiratorial, strange theories. There's not much room there to start thinking about actual solutions in education or government, right?
Absolutely. You know, what I call it diversionary thinking. Bob Thorpe has made the statement time after time, I am going to file a lawsuit, and I'm drawing the line in the sand, and files frivolous lawsuits, suits that we pay for out of taxpayer money because of ideology. What does that have to do with developing a program that's going to be meaningful or doing something that's productive that you can measure at the end of the day? Nothing. They're wasting your taxpayers' dollars. I'm not talking thousands. I'm talking about millions of dollars on ideology. Nothing productive.
So it's not really, in some ways, even about left or right. It's about people who are sort of so absorbed in their ideology that their whole effort goes there, and people who are looking for solutions to actual Arizona problems.
You're absolutely correct. They're not. I mean, they're just hung up on their own ideology. We're trying to solve problems. These folks are do-nothings. They're a do-nothing legislature. They have so much time wrapped up and take our resources, our financial resources, our resources with time and personnel wrapped up on these frivolous lawsuits that we don't move forward. So what happens in the meantime? We fall backwards in all departments, whether it's transportation, education, health and safety, you name it. We can't afford that type of thinking. If he wants to do that, let him go start his own extreme right think tank and let the private part of the society that believes like him put their money, put their money in where their mouths are at.
So we're subsidizing their ideology.
Absolutely.
Which most Arizonans, I mean, don't agree with. I know the elections generate these extremist candidates, but I think when we do polling, right, Gary, most Arizonans are pretty moderate to slightly conservative or slightly liberal.
They tend to vote for whatever party affiliation they have, and they don't look at the candidate. And I think that's really why we have Brenda Barton and Bob Thorpe. And if you really do a look at what they've accomplished and what they believe in, I can't see many reasonable people voting for them. I'd like to also point out that many of the bills that they put forward are written by corporations for the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And so they bring these model legislative bills from corporations into the legislature, put their name on them as sponsor, and then, we have our, instead of writing bills that can solve problems in this state, we have bills written by corporations, national corporations, writing bills that they are pushing across the country, and then they hand them into the legislators in this state, people like Thorpe and Barton, and they put their name on it. It has nothing to do with Arizona's problems and solutions.
You're right. You know what? They don't understand what they've submitted, because when they're asked questions in public forums, which is very infrequently because they don't show up to them, they just stammer. They don't know what you're talking about.
They haven't
read
them.
And then the person asking the question will hold up the bill in front of them and says, "This has your name on it. You wrote it. And you don't know anything about it?" Well, no, because the corporations wrote it for them and handed it to them. And they handed it in and introduced it into the state legislature.
That's the kind of legislatures you're running against?
Absolutely. These folks don't have a clue what they're doing. They're just puppets for the corporations. And instead of serving the people, they're serving the big money boys.
And it's not even corporations generally. It's a particularly narrow group of very, very large national corporation, and very deeply influenced, Gary, right, by the Koch brothers' particular ideology about corporations. Because some corporations really don't have this ideology. Many of them have quit ALEC in protest over the craziness.
Not most of ours. Most of our conservative legislators are still members of ALEC. If you want to really understand what's going on in our legislature, go Google the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and look at the corporations as their sponsors of it, and look at the membership. I want to get to a couple other points. First of all, I want to get to veterans issues, but I want to point out that if you're a Democrat or if you're an independent and you want to change the representation for LD6 and get at least one other sane individual and carrying individual in the legislature is to do what we call the single shot vote. Instead of, you can vote for two representatives for LD6 along with a state senator for LD6.
You're saying so, not to vote for the crazy guys, Gary?
Don't vote for either of the other crazy. If you believe in good legislation, vote for Alex, and don't vote don't take your second vote. Don't vote for one or the other two. They're both the same. They're both bad, and they've not done anything for our district or for our state.
Right. And, I think that makes perfectly good sense. My finance manager for our campaign says, Alex, I'm going to help you out. I used to be part of the problem. I said, what do you mean? He says, I used to be a Republican, and now I'm going to be a Democrat. I'm going to help you out. If we single shot this, I think we can make a difference in this legislature, because if you look at the Senate, if we capture four seats, we'll have a 50-50 split. That means that the Republicans are going to have to talk to the Democrats before they write the budget.
And that's an important point, because right now there is no conversation across the aisle. Republicans have a separate caucus meeting and they decide the budget and they bring it back in and have a few minutes of discussion and then pass it, and the Democrats never even get a chance to try to influence.
Right, and there's no transparency. You hear this word a lot, transparency. All it means is putting your information, your meetings, your discussions out in public so people can hear what you have to say and then have some kind of discussion. There is no discussion with the Republicans right now. They meet at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they say no, and that's it. You don't have any clout. What I'm saying is help us get more Democrats elected. Give voice to the Democrats, the centrist. We've been on the extreme edges and periphery for too long. It's time to start getting back to business. You know, as Trump says, make America great again. Well, let's make Arizona great again, because we're an embarrassment. I talked to somebody the other day, just came back from Hong Kong, and they were at the airport, and they overheard somebody talking about where they lived in Arizona. And the first thing that came up was, what's wrong with your state?
Well, the thing I've always used is TGIM. You know, thank God for TGFM. Thank God for Mississippi, because Mississippi usually outranks us at the bottom of the barrel, and Arizona is only slightly above it.
I know a real concern of you, and we're running out of time for you and your campaign, is veterans issues. So you want to address that for a few minutes and tell us your take on veterans issues as a veteran.
Well, all of a sudden we have problems with veterans administration, and that's a federal, not a state issue with Veterans Administration, but our politicians are just scandalized because of all this. I keep asking, where were you when this was developing? You were not doing your job. You were asleep at the wheel. Well, one of the programs that we have and we can work with at the state level is a thing called Veterans Courts. This is where a judge can adjudicate the case that's before them. It's generally a veteran who's got issues because they were homeless, they were cited for being vagrants, and they don't show up to court. And then what happens, there's a warrant out for their arrest because they're in violation of not coming into court and dealing with issue. So now there's a warrant for their arrest, and they wind up in prisons. And they wind up in private prisons. And I'm going to tell you what, private prisons are all part of the Republican agenda because it's a moneymaker. Empty cells don't make money, so when you fill them up with people who are not doing any damage or any harm to you, then they make money. Everybody talks about veterans' rights. You know, they were there for us, but we're not there for them. We're allowing this to happen. Well, that stopped a while ago with veterans' courts, because veterans' courts, the judge has some leeway to find social service agencies, to find the kind of services a veteran needs. There was a lady who was telling us about a woman she knows on the reservation, where the authorities went to look for her son because he had not shown up to court. And she says, look for him in the forest. And she says, what do you mean? They asked, what do you mean? Well, he was a sniper. He hid out in the forest. You know what his crime was? He was publicly drunk, not causing a problem, but that's not okay. And he was homeless, and he was a vagrant. And that's why he wound up in jail. But when he was over in Iraq, three tours, that wasn't a problem. Nobody asked him where he lived then. He was serving his country, and yet they want to throw him in private prisons so the fat guys, the fat cats, the rich boys, however you want to label them, make money. They don't make money with empty cells, but they will make money when we put our veterans in there, and judges are stopping this.
I want to thank Alex for joining us this morning, and I want to just say a couple of words. If you care about the legislature in this state, vote for Alex Martinez for the House of Representatives, and vote for Nikki Bagley for the state Senate. And if you're interested, you can hear this, if you want to listen to this again, you can get it at our website, vvid.org, vvid.org. We have all of our shows on podcasts on that.
So, be sure to vote, folks. Alex, the last word. We've got 30 seconds.
Okay, remember, alexmartinezforarizona.com. If you want to help us, that's our website, alexmartinezforarizona.com. Again, I want to reemphasize, why am I running? It's because of local control of schools. The Republicans talk about local control, but now they're taking it away. They want to centralize it. They want to privatize it. We cannot lose local control of our schools. If you care about public school education, if you care about your tax dollars, but more importantly, your children, local control. Don't forget, vote for me is for local control of your schools. Thank you. And remember, Alex Martinez for Arizona.com.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.